Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on the Big Lead. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. We are joined by Nancy Faust Jenkins, who played organ for the White Sox for 40 years, and Roger Wallenstein, who writes a weekly White Sox column for the Beachwood Reporter. Roger was the co-director of the summer camp, Camp Nebagamon, that I went to growing up in northern Wisconsin. So Nancy was recently inducted into the Hall of Eternals in the baseball reliquary. Tell me about what that is and how you found yourself getting inducted into a museum alongside Tommy John.
Pretty exciting to be keeping company like that, Ryan. I first learned about it when I was notified by them, and they're a national organization based in Pasadena at Whittier College. And for 20 years now, they have inducted three people per year into their, what they call the Shrine of Eternals. And these are people that the public votes for. The members of the baseball reliquary do the voting. And it's for people that have influenced the game of baseball in non-traditional ways. Not necessarily by statistics, but other parts of the big picture of baseball. And I understand this was the fourth year that my name was on the ballot, because the ballot has 50 candidates every year. And the top three,
and they snubbed you the first three times.
That's okay. But
who did you get snubbed in favor of? Do you know?
I do not know, but I do know the names that were right below mine in terms of voting when I was inducted last week.
Who was that?
Leo DeRocher and Bob Costas.
Ah, Bob Costas got beat out. Do you think he was disappointed?
Oh, I don't think so. I'm sure he's got many accolades. But it was most exciting for me, and they flew me out there to Pasadena, and I made my speech, but it was fun to hear Tommy John. And then the late Rusty Staub was the third inductee. His sister accepted the award.
Roger, I'm going to put you on the spot real quick. So when we were doing research, I read about her getting into the Hall of Eternals, and there was a blog post that said that they should build a statue of her outside Guaranteed Rate Field. Do you think that she accomplished enough to warrant a statue?
Well, when you think about it, with 40 years in Comiskey Park and the new ballpark, which is now Guaranteed Rate Field, I think it's certainly a cause for consideration.
Okay. Yes. You should put her on the ballot.
Who else has been there longer than 40 years? I'd have to think about it. Some of the vendors, maybe.
At my time of retirement, I was probably one of the longer-term employees.
For sure.
My first year was 1970, and that was when John Allen owned the team. And then he sold to Bill Veeck. And that was Bill Veeck's second time around. And he was a colorful owner. Great to work for Bill.
Okay, give us an example. Everyone knows he's a colorful owner, but how did his color directly impact you? What was a time that was specifically memorable that defines him to somebody who maybe isn't intimately familiar with him?
Well, Bill Veeck was known for his wacky promotions. He wanted to engage fans in ways that would make them attracted to the ballpark, even if the team wasn't doing well. And so he had these wacky promotions. We all know about Disco Demolition because that went bad. But there were so many others. You know, he would give every ethnic group a night with their national anthem and their parades and their costumes, and he'd have a circus night or anti-superstition night or a music night where anybody who brought any kind of a musical instrument could get into the park for free, even if it was a comb and a piece of paper or a kazoo. So he was just known for his wacky promotions. He was also, he did wacky stunts like hiring Eddie Goodell, the midget, to bat so that the zone was so little. But he did wacky things. And I guess working for him during a time before Jumbotron or pre-recorded music, so I provided all the music.
Right, and he put you right in the middle of all of the fans.
Exactly. It was Bill Veeck that put the organist, the first organist, with the fans instead of isolated in a booth. So that gave me some visual recognition, I suppose. But it was my job to provide the music that would reflect the atmosphere of whatever the promotion was. And that my repertoire had to be pretty varied because it was something different all the time.
There's videos deep in the archives of the internet of Roger on television with Bill Veeck just drinking in a bar, talking baseball. What do you remember about that?
Well, this was in 1984. WTTW had a show called the Instant Replay Show, and Bill had a segment on it where he was the bartender, and it wasn't in a bar. It was a set that they built there.
Okay.
And I was the patron, and it was real beer because Bill was, of all the people I've ever seen, could drink more beer than anyone I've ever known without getting up to go to the washroom, by the way. And so he would have a topic, and I would feed him a couple of lines, and he would then pontificate on whether it was about the umpiring or inability to hit to the opposite field or whatever, or the contracts. And so we had always would go out afterward, and some of the moments in my life that I value the most. But I also want to add, while he was known for a lot of the promotions, which were amazing, he also won a pennant in Cleveland in 1948 and another one in Chicago in 1959. So he knew players, and he knew how to handle people, and it was in the days when he spent five nights a week out at YMCAs and churches and synagogues and schools selling tickets, promoting the team all winter long, and he never quit. And, you know, in this day and age, most of the owners are sequestered behind office doors or whatever. He took the door to his office off the...
Yeah, he was very visible, and I understand his telephone number was always in the phone book. If a fan had an idea, he would accept it. He was a fan's man, for sure.
Right. He loved people.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. He listened to them.
Have an example of a time you went to him and asked for something, I don't know, organizational-wide or personally,
yeah,
and then it happened?
Yeah, a great example, if you look out my back window. One of his promotions was called Ragtime Night, and it involved a lot of wacky door prizes. And one of the door prizes was not claimed by a fan. So I asked Bill personally, I said, you know, nobody's claimed it. Do you suppose I could take it home and have it? And he said, sure, take it. Well, it was a donkey. And it was a wonderful pet.
And you had the property at the time to accommodate that type
did.
Of thing?
Yes, we had a little, we lived in Des Plaines, Illinois, and we had about an acre and a little barn. So we were able to accommodate it, and we had it for many years, and she was a great pet. She had been donated by Adventureland, and so had nobody claimed her, they would have just returned her. But I got her, and so now I have her successor.
What is something that people wouldn't know about owning pet donkeys?
Well, that they're very sociable, and they're very friendly, and they like attention, and they're smart. They're trainable. You can ride them. I have kids over it during the birthdays, and she rings her bell, and she counts, and she stands on a pedestal and waves. So they're very trainable and sociable.
Roger, if you had won a donkey in this promotion, would you have packed up your wife to accommodate it, or would
Nancy
you think you would have gotten
Nancy? I think he used to do things like you'd get a year's supply of popsicles or something like that were delivered to your seat.
Yeah. I always wondered who might have won that donkey and rejected it. And just last year, I played for something for Hoekstra, who wrote something about Steve Dahl and Disco Demolition, mm-hmm. and it was a promotion for a book. And a man that attended it said, didn't you have a donkey? And I said, yes. And he said, my brother won that. So I finally met him, and he lives here in
Northbrook. Really?
Illinois.
No kidding. Yeah. Wow.
So we've glossed over Disco Demolition a couple times. What are your recollections of the night and how you felt at the time about it?
Well, I was just going along with everybody yelling, Disco sucks, because it was still lighthearted and, you know, it hadn't been out of hand yet. So I'm doing duh, 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 to them, people are saying, and I'm told by a good friend that I still stay in touch with, that there were three nuns in front of the organ sitting next near him, and they're saying, what's everybody saying? Well, they didn't want to say disco sucks in those days. So he said, well, they're all yelling, let's go Sox. So those three nuns just joined in, clapped along, and had a good time. But it did
But then?
Yeah, that was frightening. And I remember Bill Veeck getting on the microphone and saying, please take your seats, and begging with people. And Harry singing, had me play Hey, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, but nothing calmed the masses. So the game was second game was forfeited.
What do you remember about that at the time? Like,
how
was it
there.
Covered?
I was at a lot of games. That's 78, I believe.
79.
79, okay. And I wasn't there. My friend Tom was there. And I guess there were about 55,000 people in the park and about 20 or 25 outside the park trying to get in. And I didn't care that much about disco, but I cared about the Sox beating the Tigers. And it wasn't good. And I guess what's concerned me in days since then is that it was Michael Veeck hatched the idea with Steve Dahl. And I don't think Bill knew much about disco, but he said, sure, let's try it. And unfortunately, people remember a lot about Disco Demolition and not about some of the good times.
It really put Steve Dahl on the map.
At the time this happened, did you think people are still going to be talking about it 40 years from now, writing books, asking you about it at your kitchen table, et cetera, et cetera?
I'm certain, probably not. Certainly not. But yeah, I guess the legend grows.
It's just hard because I can't envision right now a morning talk radio host riling up 50,000 people to go and protest a type of content that they don't like. What does it matter? Like, okay, I like rock, he likes disco. Who is going to like participate in a march against, I don't know, a genre of music like that?
I guess he just had a following that that was unforeseen. But I can't imagine it happening again. And I'm sure, like you said, Bill Veeck never imagined that would turn into such a...
What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think about Harry Carey?
A fun-loving, super salesman. He was brought in to help attendance, and I think he did. And he... any aspect of the game that was promotable, you'd hear him say. And I was very fortunate to work with him because the music was just one more aspect that he promoted of the many, anything that was attractive about a baseball game.
Would you say that it's an accurate recollection on Roger's part? He was saying on the way here that he really helped you become almost like a household name in Chicago and even beyond with Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And people remember that for the Cubs, but he was doing that with the White Sox.
There wasn't a time that he'd sing that he wouldn't say, okay, Nancy, let me hear you.
A one and a two
so,
and a three.
It's like, who is this Nancy?
You know? Right. No, when... I became very aware of you when he did that. But whose idea was it originally?
To sing? Well,
that he would sing, and he couldn't sing for very well.
That was what the charm was, because he was good.
Right, like any fan. But where did the idea come from to, you know, okay?
Well, the fans always did sing.
Right.
And because of where the organ was placed, we could see each other. He could see me. So it just made sense that he'd say, okay, like maestro, you know, take it away. Because he... visual contact. And so when Bill Veeck handed him the microphone and convinced him to lead everybody, because people were always looking up at him because he waved his arms as he sang. He just, you couldn't hear him.
Right.
And it was a natural evolution, I think we'd say.
What do you remember about that?
I just, as Nancy was saying, he would you'd look up at the booth and he'd be leaning out the window and sort of directing traffic and singing. But then they put the microphone in his hand and Nancy would play along with him and then get over that. And then if the Tigers were in town, you'd play Hold That Tiger. And
oh, my gosh. All the cat songs, Cat Scratch
Fever. You had a repertoire that has got to be unmatched. It was, you know, and not just the old, you know, standards, but if a new song came out, it seemed like you were right on it.
I was. Well, I know every song my mother ever knew, and because I play by ear, I mean, if you just ask me to play a jingle from a commercial, I could do it even if I've never heard it before.
Do you read music?
Not well, but I know how, but I don't sight read.
So you just hear something and then you can play it back right away. Like, for example, I saw a video of you playing like Dancing Queen by ABBA. You just hear it once and you can play it?
Well, now that I know the video you're talking about, and I incorporated like my sequencer and a drum, and that takes time because I want to make background for it. But if I just want to play something and get it across, no problem. Hmm. So for me, it was always fun to hear new names come up to bat. Or something unforeseen that would happen. Let's say a cat runs out in the field and you play Cat Scratch Fever, or somebody loses a ball in the sunlight and you play Blinded by the Light. And then I wear my sunglasses when he puts them on. Just, I love that stuff. Somebody had a hold up a game because there'd be a swarm of bugs and I'd play Flight of the Bumblebee. I was in my glory, you know, just
now, did you,
being a soundtrack.
Did you ever play Three Blind Mice when the umpire made a bad call?
No, that's... somebody may have.
I think they. That must have been a Wrigley Field.
Perhaps, or it might have even been a minor league game or something. But that was too obvious for me. I would. I like the more. I like the Inna Gata DeVita for In Caviglia. I like that kind of thing.
And they I read that you got sent a gold record for reviving the Na 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 song, and doing that with the pitchers getting taken out.
Actually, Mercury Records presented me with the gold record in a ceremony on the field before a game because they re-released the record. It started getting popular not only at our time.
Now it's just a staple at all sports, even still. It's endured.
It's nothing you could plan, but it just happened. Nope. You know, and it was the days of Bill Veeck when the fans were just having a good time.
77, right?
Yeah.
That was the best.
Yes.
To me, that was even more than 05 was the most fun season I ever had there.
You couldn't predict it, you know. And I remember then other ball teams would bring their organist and say, listen to her. Now you go back and you do something like that. But you can't make that happen. It was just all right.
The White Sox had two people that other people emulated, you and Gene Bosser, and then Roger Bosser, because they were, you know, the sort of the standard when it came to groundskeepers, and you were the standard when it came to playing the organ.
And like I said, those were the times before pre-recorded music. That was before Jumbotron, where now all the downtime is taken up with other things. But in those days, the downtime belonged to me. I know, but now it's generates a lot of money.
How old were you when you started playing the organ?
I was about 4 when my parents bought an organ. They bought an organ from my mother, who was a musician, and it was just a way for her to, because the organ was becoming popular, just to bloom out besides piano and accordion. You know, it was just another instrument for her to play.
Now the most famous organ is the Hammond
Hammond B3.
Hammond
B3. Which we have in that room. I'll play a song later if you want.
Cool, we'll do that.
The Hammond B3.
And in fact, they no longer make them, but when you hear an organ in a rock song from the 70s and 80s, it's a B3. And you still see it on the set for Saturday Night Live.
They don't make them anymore.
Oh, not since the 70s.
Why?
So what does one of those go for?
That's a good question. Depends on, you know, the
condition
buyer.
And
yeah.
The buyer.
But I've seen them ask maybe 10,000-12,000 for one that if you can find one that's still in good shape.
And when people used to ask for advice, you'd say have like a big repertoire, otherwise you can become irrelevant, right?
Boy, that's exactly what I'd say. Yeah, to have something for everything. Don't play too quickly because fans, when they want to sing along or chant along, don't equate quality with speed, you know.
If you had to guess, how many different songs did you play in your tenure?
Oh, I would know, but you know, I have to tell you that also that I had the advantage of seeing a scoreboard with messages, and that was always a cue for a song. The messages were welcoming people. This is somebody got married. Welcome to Coca-Cola. I play Coca-Cola. So welcome Budweiser. I had Budweiser sending me plaques and gifts that I just because they heard their song played. You know, Keebler cookie, anything that had a jingle. And if they were welcome to our park on the scoreboard, I was able to reflect that. So that also gave me. It wasn't just walk-up music that I played. It was like a soundtrack for if you saw a rainbow or if it started to rain or the grounds crew's guy had a come out and pull the tarp, I'd be playing da-da-da-da-da as the or as the manager came out to replace the pitcher, you know, I'd play Jaws or, you know, I don't know, things like that.
Did... What type of like opportunities did this open up, not just in other sports, which we'll get to, but just I'm sure you were in demand to play, I don't know, weddings, bar mitzvahs, etc.
No, actually, I was pretty much into just the sports.
Okay.
And I played for sports themed parties. Every once in a while, I'd get a call and they'd say, "Oh, we're having a." It was basketball. I did play for the Bulls for a while and the Blackhawks and the Sting, and then I used to fly up to Minnesota and play for the North Stars.
Well, wait a minute. In the old Chicago Stadium, there was a huge pipe organ.
That's correct.
Did you play that?
I did.
Shea Torrent, I think, was that his name?
No, Al Melgard.
Al Melgard.
Al Melgard was the organist for the Blackhawks.
Al Melgard, right.
At the stadium.
And you obviously knew him.
My mother did, actually. When she started playing when I was four, she took a few lessons from him.
So, did you ever play that organ in,
yes,
the, in the old stadium?
Yes, I did. When I played for the Blackhawks, I did. Yeah. But I'm more comfortable on electronic equipment.
So you sold low on the Bulls and got out right before Michael Jordan got in there.
I kid. I used to say, well, they couldn't afford both of us. So. They said, well, what should we do? Well, we went with the player. Yeah, they're not the Jordan player.
What are the pre-Jordan Bulls like? Is there any type of sense that they can, 10 years from now, win 6 titles with like the greatest player ever? Or is there a sense of indifference amongst the fans?
When I played there, I remember the organ was right there on the floor. And if I brought guests, I'd sit them right down on the floor, right near me, right near the box, the press box. There weren't that many people coming to the games then. And, no, there was no sense that they were about to turn things around with Michael Jordan,
What stands out to you, Roger, about the pre-Jordan Bulls?
When you first got there?
Well, just before, because she was 79 to 84, right?
I think you could drive a freight train through there even when Jordan was on the team. You could just walk in and buy a ticket and
sit on the floor.
Sit wherever you were, right. Because third quarter, you can't get there, then the game starts, fine. Show up in the second half. So.
But then when he... Well, in the
you got to understand that when he was a college player, he was a very good player, but nothing like when he was a pro because of Dean Smith's offense. He wasn't shooting all the time, so it was a much different. What was he? He was a third pick, I believe.
Yeah.
The two guys went ahead of him. The big guy who never did anything.
Bowie.
And Olajuwon. So Bulls got the third choice, and I don't. It wasn't such a big deal, but then things changed.
Well, I'll say.
And then with the Blackhawks, right now I'd argue that the Blackhawks are more relevant than the Bulls. Not in all of Chicago, because I don't think that the Blackhawks reach people of color. But I think if you're starting at the Sears Tower and go like north through Gurnee, the Blackhawks are more relevant than the Bulls. Like, you've seen that coming ever?
Roger.
Well, they won 3 Stanley Cups after and they weren't on television when the old man was alive, and then when he died and Rocky put him on TV.
That was a good
move. Oh, yeah, and they discovered that about baseball years ago. It didn't diminish interest; it created interest. So the Stanley Cups and putting him on television made a huge difference. But in the old days. The rap on them was that the stadium seated 16,666 for hockey, and that's exactly how many fans they had, throughout the, that was it.
But they were big fans of the Blackhawks even then, right?
Yeah, but they weren't on television, and so if you didn't go to the game, you didn't see them.
Yeah, so it was...
Even their road games, were their road games not on TV?
Nothing was on television.
Wow.
He thought it would diminish interest, and...
I think he's been proven wrong.
Yeah.
That's kind of Harry having gone to the Cubs and then getting all this national exposure because they were a superstation. I mean, he's just known all over.
Well, we were talking about that when Reinsdorf and Einhorn bought the team and Eddie started the sports vision thing, uh-huh. Which you were getting free before you had to pay. And I can remember Harry say, why should I do that? I can go over here and everybody's going to see me around the country.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm just going to be heard by the people who pay the subscription fee. And out the door he went.
Yeah.
Did you keep in touch with him after he left? Or?
Yeah, I think I did. Well, I've run into him at certain functions that I would play for. And I know when he passed away, they had a celebration of his life at his restaurant, and I played for that. And I've stayed in touch with his wife, Dutchie, and talked to her occasionally.
I don't know if you're going to answer, but he obviously was a legendary drinker. Do you have any great Harry Carey alcohol imbibement stories?
Well, I know he held that Falstaff cup, right? And I was told that he had scotch in there. I don't know if it's true.
That's true. Well, I can remember him in the bards room. He presented himself as a great beer drinker, but I never saw him drink beer. He was always drinking scotch. Anyway.
And I think he must have gotten little sleep because he wanted to go out after games, and he had good friends that Gladys, Jack, gone, and that was the beginning of their night when the game ended.
Right. Those were very different days.
Absolutely.
Did you feel any type of disappointment when he went to the Cubs, or did you like, okay, I understand this is a business decision on his part, no hard feelings?
It's always hard to adjust to something new, and I was comfortable with working with Harry, and I felt bad at the time, sure. Yeah, I wished him well. And in fact, he said to me, Nancy, you ought to go over there. And I said, well, they ought to ask me. And in fact, I did have an offer from the Cubs. I don't remember if that was before. I think it was before Harry even went. But Bill Beck owned the team. And I said, Bill, I have an offer here from the Cubs. And if I could play there if there's no conflicting games. And Bill said, young lady, you do one or the other. That was it. I was scared of me, but
did you have a sense of a rivalry between the two teams other than that, or did you not really? I don't know.
I think I did because I was so close to fans that I hear a lot of this, you know, Cubs suck or Sox suck, and I'd see T-shirts worn that it was hard to love them both. I guess for me, I wasn't raised as a sports fan. I was just happy to had a job, and I wanted everybody to do well.
So as a kid, you weren't a baseball fan.
Not at all. In fact, when the Sox won that pennant in '59, and the sirens went off, I was terrified. I thought, this is that Cold War. I'm so afraid about it.
You and a lot of other people.
Yeah.
So you lived in the city then?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. September 22nd, 1959.
And my grandparents were taking care of us because my mother was out working and with my dad someplace, and they were immigrants from Sweden. They didn't know. I didn't have a clue what's going on, you know.
Yeah.
And I called my cousin's house and said, what's happening? And first they called the operator, called dial zero, and she said, I'm sorry, we have no information. I remember this because I've repeated this story so many times. Then I called my cousin. She was real close to me. And she said, oh, we're all celebrating over here. She was a big Sox fan. She loved Rocky Colavito. She collected baseball cards.
Well, Daly was a Southsider from Bridgeport, so he said, yeah, there's a story, though. I think Fire Commissioner Quinn actually took credit for turning the sirens on. But these were the days when in school you would have air raid drills where you'd get under your desk like that was going to stop you from an atomic bomb. But that was the mentality, and he set the sirens off.
So
and
for some that weren't into sports.
Right, if you weren't watching the White Sox.
You didn't know. Or even if you were watching the White Sox and could have been a coincidence.
You never know.
It's true. It probably wasn't a wise decision, but it makes for a good story.
Yeah.
And so, did you ever, because you were in this job, did you have your emotions tied up with whether the team won or lost? Or was it just basically like, okay, I'm done with work, I'm going home?
I really enjoyed the feedback from the fans. And I know everybody was happier when they won. Of course, I wanted them to win because I worked for them. But it didn't wreck my night or anything. I wasn't like, I know people now that are both Cubs and Sox fans, and they just don't talk to them if their team loses. I was never like that.
My wife would say I'm like that with the Packers, and I guess that's probably fair
really?
To say, yeah.
How is that fair?
But not growing up a baseball fan, you must have learned a lot about the ins and outs of the game, didn't you?
I learned enough to get by. I mean, well, as far as playing, I mean, I learned terms because fans were near me. I learned what it meant to go to the showers or walk to first base or steal a base. So there's always songs about walking and stealing and changing pitchers and going to the showers and home run and home, all the home
songs. See, that seems amazing to me because with all the nuances, your music reflected the nuances of the game.
Yeah, I think it did.
So it was more instinctive than calculated.
Absolutely. It's just spontaneous. Everything was spontaneous, and when I got home, I couldn't tell you who did what, who made a first, who got to first or third or struck out. I just played for whatever happened right then. I mean, I'd see the name on the back of the shirt, I'd know who's up to bat, or I'd have a roster and I'd know number seven was.
Well, let me ask you this. Everything today is so orchestrated. You know, there's a production team for the games, and there's a production booth. It's like almost like a, I don't know, like a big, huge Broadway play or something.
Yeah.
So was there when you came to work, was there like a schedule of here's what you play this inning?
Nothing. But when I was first hired by the late Stu Holcomb, who prior to that was a general manager, wasn't he the
He was the athletic director at Northwestern, but he was also a football coach.
Football coach at Purdue.
Exactly.
But he was the general manager that heard me play at a banquet, and he hired me to play for the White Sox. And I said, oh, I can play anything, which I can. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, here's a list of songs. And here's each player's home state. He said, could you play their home state when they come up to bat? So in a way, that was a form of welcome music. And I think there was a Bart Johnson, and he was from California. Yeah. And I remember playing, California, here we come. now, as the time went on, I played more like Hotel California or City of Angels or something. But,
In the city of Chicago, there's a little bit of a Big Brother, Little Brother thing with the Cubs and White Sox. But in 2005, the White Sox won first. Was there a little bit of extra emotion about getting off the schneid, not just getting off it, but beating the Cubs to that ring?
I was so heartwarmed to see the turnout, because there was no faction, I think you'd call it, over there of Cub fans saying, we don't want you. Everybody was positive. There were no evil acts, you know, no fires or overturned cars or anything. It was like the whole city came out to support the Sox. That was just very heartwarming. I was very proud to be associated with the White Sox.
Were you happy to beat the Cubs to that?
I just was happy to see the Sox win the World Series before I died, basically.
Oh,
and then, when I saw that the Cubs on their marquee at Clark and Addison, congratulations, White Sox.
Wow.
I thought that was a nice gesture. But I have some of my best friends are Cub fans. They said, you know, congratulations, I'm happy for you. And that was, which is sort of the way I felt in 2016 when the Cubs won.
Well, I don't think we thought, well, we beat the Cubs.
No.
Because it was like hopeless. The Cubs weren't ever going to win. They weren't supposed to. What would you do if they did? It's like, how would we act?
But a lot of people don't realize that right before you came on with the Sox, from 51 to 68, the White Sox outdrew the Cubs every year but one year.
I heard that.
And then when you came on, Nancy,
she sunk the ship.
Well, they
it was a great year to break in.
In all due respect, the Allens almost sunk the ship. They were not baseball people, and things.
I think the lowest attendance ever was my first year at the ballpark tank, and plus the organ at that time was located in center field bleachers. There was nobody out there.
They drew 495,000 people that year.
Wow, you know your baseball.
Right? I know White Sox baseball, but that's right. It was the lowest attendance in their history.
So
you were
for
playing.
Me, it was great.
There were some crowds under 1,000 people at the beginning and end of the season.
Well, I remember Stu saying, how he'd say, oh gosh, we lost just when we had a good crowd, like 8,000 here, and we lost.
That's right.
I remember him saying.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Was there any player that you became like particularly attached to because you liked his grit or his power or anything like that?
Oh, I enjoyed watching Richie Allen come up to bat. He just had this stance about him. I've never met Richie Allen until recently, when I think there's an effort to get him into the Hall of Fame, but I liked Richie Allen. Some were super friendly. There used to be a caravan of White Sox players that would go around to the different cities and try to promote baseball, and they'd bring me with so I could play the organ and do a promotion. And so then we'd get to meet some of the players and they were really, Joe, who are some of those players that we used to meet that were so nice?
Hello,
my husband Joe just walked in. Oh, well, there was Ron Kittle, so friendly, and we're this is Joe.
Hey, nice
Ryan
to meet you.
Roger.
How you doing?
Roger's baseball historian.
Well, yes.
He knows more about the Sox.
I met a guy named Rory Clark, who was the bat boy. He went to St. Ignatius when Dick Allen played for the Sox. And Richie, Dick, don't call me Richie Allen, remember that?
Yeah.
He sort of exuded coolness.
And
he would hit the ball up the gap, and he would basically jog to second base. And Rory once asked him, he said, you're a great superstar, but why do you just jog to second on those doubles? And he said, Rory, he said, there's two ways to look at it. He says, you got your double run and your triples run. You run hard on a triple, you don't run so hard on a double. He knew what the result was going
to
be as soon as it left.
He knew how to pace himself.
Oh, my. Well, and that's probably why he's never going to get in the Hall of Fame, because it never endeared himself to the writers. They were, and then his career ended out. What was that, 73 when he?
Is that when he went to horse racing or something?
Yeah, he liked the ponies.
Well, you don't think like some sabermetrician could dig him up and be like, look at his OPS or something like that?
Oh yeah, but he only played about 12 seasons, I think, and he talent wise, no one had more talent than the guy. I mean, he was something. That what was the season? Was it 72 when he was MVP? With the 37 homers?
I don't know yet, but yeah, he should have been every year I saw him, he could have been MVP.
He was amazing.
So I came in contact with Nancy because I went to a Brewers game and wound up sitting next to her son, Eric. And one thing that he said is that you have a letter from Cubs ownership saying that so Nancy had apparently applied and said in her credentials that she could play the national anthem. And the Cubs owner, and this is very interesting based on how many of the conversations we have about the national anthem today, it was like, well, we don't play the national anthem.
Exactly. I have the letter if you want to read it.
Yeah, I would, definitely.
Joe, would you mind getting that letter? It's on our dresser in the bedroom. But yeah, I think Philip Redley felt that that would be commercializing, it would be commercializing the anthem, and it belonged not in with sports. The sports was the escape.
Well, if only the NFL owners could go back in time and take his advice and never start playing the anthem or have standardized rules like the NBA does, I think we would have avoided a lot of unpleasant conversations over the last few years.
I'd really forgotten all about this letter, and we had just recently going in the basement going through some things, and I found this letter. And it was actually, I don't know that I wrote the letter requesting that I play the anthem, but I had friends that were Cubs fans.
Wow.
That felt I should be doing it. And so they wrote on my behalf, but he answered to me at my house.
Wow. So here's what it says. It says, because of the Vietnam War, which has certainly developed into a war, although it is still undeclared, we considered very seriously playing the national anthem before every game and definitely decided toward the end of the season that we would play it regularly during the 1967 season if the undeclared war continues. Therefore, we had our plans pretty well set some time ago, and the services of an organist was engaged. Interesting.
Yeah.
So wait, they said they do play the national anthem, but they...
Only on special occasions, like perhaps the 4th of July or Memorial Day.
It's signed by Philip K. Wrigley.
Dated February 13th, 1967.
That's really something.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Did you ever miss a game?
I missed 5 games when the fellow you met, Eric, my son, was born.
5 games in 40 years?
Yeah, it was bad timing.
Cal Ripken.
Not Eric's fault, just bad timing, right?
Why couldn't he come on a Western road trip?
So you must have gone out there and worked when you were not feeling great every night.
Oh, I felt fine. Yeah, and it was like spring, and I had a coat. You know, I was wearing a coat.
But I'm talking about every other year, opening days, in April, you had some cold weather.
I did. Sometimes I look back and I wonder how I did the commute and how I withstood the late hours sometimes and the cold weather. But it's just something you do because that's your job.
And the traffic.
Yeah.
They talk about Hawk Harrelson driving to South Bend. Well, your drive out here was almost as long.
I used to, from here, I would allow 2 hours to get to the game.
So you drove, you didn't take the train.
No. But coming home at night, sometimes I just want to fall asleep behind the wheel. It was almost dangerous. This is quite a commute.
2 hours.
Coming home was an hour, but getting there could be 2 hours.
And the traffic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
40 years.
Yes. 41 years, Roger.
41.
You know who might be the most parallel iteration of what you do today? Have you heard of this guy, Sir Foster, on the Atlanta Hawks?
I've seen his name on the internet. I've never met him.
Yeah, he plays, if there's a new song, he's on it. And he's like pretty popular in terms of like when you're watching the Hawks on NBA League Pass, figuring out what he's playing.
I see. I haven't. Now, one organist that I do know that's really good is Josh Cantor, who plays for the Boston Red Sox. And he's from Evanston.
He bought your organ, right?
Boy, you really know everything. Yes, he did. So when I auctioned an organ to when I gave it to the ballpark, they auctioned it for and it was Josh, who plays for the Red Sox, who bought the organ.
So let me get this straight. The organ you played all those years was your organ? It didn't belong to the ball club?
No, it's just that I gave up the organ that I had practiced that had been in our house for.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It was because we thought we'd bring a B3 in. Because we were renting B3s and we had to do something with it. So we said, well, we'll keep the B3 and we'll...
Was there ever a time you had a blooper in a big moment and hit the wrong key or something?
I'm sure I hit a lot of wrong keys. You just keep going, you know. I'm sure I do that, probably did that a lot. But you cover it up and just keep going. And I think one of the worst things that I did was the first day that I was on the job, when I was told later that when everybody was asked to stand for a moment of silence, I thought they were standing for the national anthem.
Oh, and you started playing it?
Because nobody was there, remember, Roger?
Yeah, no.
Yeah. So he said, and I didn't know until they told me, but he said, that's okay.
Did you have a contract when you were working?
Yes, I did.
One-year contract?
Sometimes one, sometimes three, sometimes five.
Do you have an agent?
No.
So you went in and negotiated your contract.
Yes, that's correct.
With the general...
Whoever, usually it was with Howard Pizer.
Sure.
One of the vice president.
I think he's our treasurer, vice president, treasurer.
That's who I dealt with.
Do you think that they missed an opportunity not building a more distinctive ballpark?
Oh, what do you think, Roger?
Yes, I think Nancy, you can talk more about this than I, but from a fan's point of view, when they built originally, I guess they still called it Comiskey Park at the beginning.
Yeah,
they?
It came kind of right before Camden Yards and Jacobs Field, and saw what these beautiful, well-architectured buildings could be, and then all of a sudden the White Sox are stuck with a drab building to the stay.
If they kept building ballparks like when they in Cincinnati and St. Louis and the sort of the round Philadelphia, if they kept building those kind of ballparks, then the present ballpark on the south side, would have been fine. No one would have. But then, like you say, Camden Yards, Seattle, San Francisco, all the new ballparks. That
PNC
really
is gorgeous in Pittsburgh.
A lot of character. And,
I think the Sox, we thought we really had something with the new park, and it just started to pale, as like you said, as the others came along. It's like, it could have been a lot better.
And growing up in the old park,
it
was heart-wrenching to see them with a Wreckers ball knocking it down.
Do you think if they could do it over in their heart of hearts, they would keep the old stadium so they could have this special old building like the Cubs, Red Sox, and Packers have? Or would they just want the luxury suites and get a new building?
I think there's a lot of money in luxury suites.
The suites, and then they had an engineer go through and evaluate the park. Remember that?
What it would have taken to get it up to code, it was falling down. I mean, they had nets catching chunks of plaster that were falling.
It's just like Wrigley Field today.
But there is a lot of charm to something that's been around.
Is there anything that we didn't discuss that either you two think is really interesting and want to talk about right now?
Well, there's...
Lots.
We mentioned this before. I had a brother who was a minor league executive for a long time. That was his. But they always had organists at minor league parks. Always. And do you know what was the origin of why organs? I mean, it goes back. I mean, do you know the history?
Well, I can see where an organ is great because it creates a lot of sound and it's electronic and you can pipe it through the whole stadium, unlike roving trios that used to walk around making music where you only a little bit could hear wherever they were standing. It just lent itself to the venue. I think our first organist at Comiskey or whatever you call it now is Guaranteed Rate was brought there by Bill Veeck, the year after the pennant. That was in that would be in 1960 when he hired Shea Torrent.
Oh, Shea Torrent was there.
Yeah, he knew that name.
Okay,
yeah.
I got him mixed up then with Al Melgart.
He was a great organist.
Shea or Al or both?
Shea was really good.
And you followed him?
No, I followed somebody else that followed Shea, but he wasn't there too long. But Shea moved out to California and played for the Angels for many years.
Oh, okay. I think I remember seeing a record of his, maybe in an old record.
I had a couple of his and I can't find them. But boy, things have changed since Shea played for the Angels. Because when Joe and I were there last week, we went to a Sox Angels game, and there's no organist. But it wouldn't, if there were, there'd be just an occasional charge, which is kind of what the organist's role has been reduced to oftentimes. But it was like walking into a pinball arcade.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really.
I've been there.
All the senses were just, you know, blown away with the noise and the lights and the flashing lights. But I think they're competing with Disneyland out there.
Look, I'm a dinosaur, and in many ways you are as well, but it almost says the game is not good enough. We have to dress it up. And for me, the game is good enough. The NBA is the biggest abuser of that. And
yeah, they play during the play.
Yeah.
But while it's on, they have the music piped in.
And, I'm happy with the games. I don't need all the lights and whistles and music.
It's almost secondary.
But here's the thing, though. They know they've got you no matter what they do to it. So they want to bring more people into the tent because they say, well, the diehards are going to watch us no matter what we do. So that's their business end of it is all on the margins and getting casual people into the building. And so that's where they're doing it.
The youth. I think they're aiming at to get the kids involved. And
there's not a big sense of there's patience is not the greatest
tradition gets lost in the shuffle for sure, and
it just really has changed.
And baseball's probably of all the games we have is the most traditional.
Yeah.
So
it's a hard adjustment for many.
Although now the pacing of the game is so different because there's just no base runners anymore. It's just strikeout, walk, solo, home run.
You're right. It's very different than it was years ago when
a pitcher pitched a whole game.
So are you still playing Sundays for the Kane County Cougars, or did that come to an end?
It came to an end, so we have our weekends, but it was fun. It kept me on top of new songs. So now if I do play out, I say, well, you won't hear anything from the last couple of years. I just don't know what's being played anymore. I get by with it.
It's an honor to sit down with a legend. That's all I got to say.
Thank you very much. We had a lot of fun with this. Once again, that is Nancy Faust Jenkins. She was the organist for the White Sox for 40 years. Roger Wallenstein writes a weekly baseball column for the Beachwood Reporter. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. Thank you to everybody who made it this far.
Such turned strange.